Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
There have been innumerable inventions that have never seen the light of day, and it is an interesting exercise to imagine how they might have changed the world. What if Leonardo da Vinci's design for a human-powered flying machine, conceived in the 1400s, had been realized? How would our world have looked after 600 years of flight? In this month's story, a visit to an out-of-the-way hotel leads to the discovery of a very unusual but still functioning invention. We invite you now to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories 59, The Gap. Somewhere in some time, one person's obsession might prove to be another's salvation. It has been perhaps half a century since my first visit to The Gap, but I have never told anyone about that trip. Instead, I have kept the memory tucked away until recently in a safe part of my mind where I could conveniently ignore it. Now, standing here, looking down at the rubble, fringed by scrubby ash-fed shrubs, it's difficult to believe that it's been apparently destroyed, purged by a fire some years previous. My heart had sunk as soon as I had spotted the ruin where the steep red tin roof should have been. Earlier, hope and desperation had propelled me up the nearly impassable highway, which was the only way to reach the Gap Hotel. Several particularly bad landslides and washouts had almost forced me to turn back. Each one coerced me into reevaluating why I was doing this, and each time I had to concede that there was no choice but to continue, no matter what the risks were.
When had they stopped maintaining the road? After the fire?
I wondered aloud to the indifferent rocky cliffs. Internally, I answered my own question. I suppose that one of the only reasons to use the old highway was to get to the hotel, and after the new high-speed train went in on the other side of the valley and the hotel burnt down, why bother? But the last time I was here, the road still flowed with overloaded transport trucks, groaning up the climb into the narrow valley, and the odd foolish driver who was too cheap to pay the toll for the then new, now also abandoned, direct four-lane route to the coast. Fewer still these days opt to drive, especially to a place with no charging station. I considered myself lucky to have found an old gas-powered Jeep to rent in a town a couple of kilometers from the nearest train station, kept working for the remote chance that an oddball tourist with too much money, like me, would be foolish enough to want to explore the crumbling, abandoned road system. It was an adventure holiday for naive tourists. I had seen one of the old ragged posters taped to the wall of the nearly bankrupt rental office, showing happy vacationers in a Jeep bouncing dramatically through the backcountry. The unseasonably warm sun was beginning to burn the top of my head, but I didn't care.
"Do your worst,"
I defiantly shouted back at its smug yellow face.
"Skin cancer, ha,"
I laughed.
"Go for it."
Fall, despite the brilliant display of color, has always been a melancholy season for me. The death of summer and the inexorable slide toward the darkness of winter always made me a bit depressed. And today, the season fitted my current state of mind. Perhaps that is why, I began to muse, some 50 years ago I was drawn here, to hide in the decay of somebody else's autumn. Now, I had to admit, I was running from my own. On the other hand, perhaps, as some fringe groups believe, there is something in the mineral-rich rocks of the mountains around this spot that acts like a magnet for those who are sensitive to its draw. At least, that's what they'd like to think. But I know that in reality, it's the subtle magnetism of the Gap. I want to believe that the Gap still exists. I came here to find it. But the fire was not that recent, and new growth had encroached on the site, obscuring most of the more obvious landmarks. Feeling desperate, I tried to imagine how it would have looked 50 years ago. But only a few details struggled upstream against an insufficient blood flow into my consciousness. Suddenly, recognizing the skeleton of the ancient cedar that had once shadowed the driveway, I began to carefully make my way downhill into the ruin, my heart complaining with each step. The hotel restaurant was empty, as the waitress showed me to a table pressed awkwardly against a wall of sliding glass doors overlooking the lake. The deck outside them had rotted through in spots, so the glass panels had been jammed shut with wooden boards to prevent anyone from going out. A shame, I thought. The deck had been the most appealing part of the place when I had first driven up. It had been a particularly hot day for the end of October, and the glare from the lake, magnified by the closed glass doors, had boiled the interior, so the waitress was still sweating even though the sun had dipped below the horizon. Every surface in the restaurant radiated back its heat, making things sticky to the touch, I discovered as I dropped into a cracked vinyl seat. The waitress, a nondescript-looking woman, somewhere between 20 and 40, dutifully produced a plastic-covered menu patched in spots with yellowed scotch tape and handed it to me.
"No air conditioning?"
I complained, hoping that at least the rooms would have AC.
"Oh, that. It's the power generator. The owner built it years ago. Didn't want to pay the energy corp, you know. Guess he never thought it would get so hot up here in the mountains this time of year. We have AC in the summer when the water's high enough in the creek, but not in the fall. Besides, we're closing for the season soon."
I gave her a questioning look.
"Not enough water to run the turbine,"
she added, then turned and grabbed a paper pumpkin off the next table, carefully placing it on mine.
"Happy Halloween, mister,"
she mechanically announced. I noticed her name on a well-worn pin. "Hello, I'm Angel," it said, in faded black letters.
"Hello, Angel,"
a tentative voice echoed down the hall from the front desk. Angel turned and left, leaving me alone with my thoughts. I had been laid off when the company moved its operations back to wherever on the planet it had originally come from, and I hadn't found work since. Over the next couple of months, the effort of looking slowly drained my will until I could barely get out of bed in the morning. Knowing that I had to do something other than end up on the street in a ball of cardboard, I finally packed up what I really needed and abandoned my modest house to head west into the mountains with the cash and credit I had left. As I drove, the mountain valleys were littered with the bones of other people's dreams, abandoned mills, decaying houses, overgrown orchards and boarded up businesses lined both sides of the highway. Then, unexpectedly, in a particularly narrow rocky valley, apparently unburdened by the failed ambitions that encroached on it, the glint of red metal from castle-like towers caught my eye. The GPS claimed nothing was there, but as I drove closer, the apparition grew into a hotel, not as perfect as it had first seemed. There were signs of disrepair, but it still stubbornly clung to life, lights outlining its oddly Bavarian silhouette against the darkening sky. Strangely drawn to it, I decided to pull off the road and stay for a night or two. Approaching voices drew my attention to the front of the restaurant. Angel returned, leading a very stressed-looking woman and a young girl of maybe around 8 or 9. The girl was lost in a game on an older handheld console. Angel led them to another table along the row of windows. They sat down, the young girl without looking up from her game, and the older woman, her mother, I suppose, ordered. Angel said something I couldn't hear, then drifted over to me.
"Had enough time to make up your mind?"
she queried. I looked back at the menu, realizing that I wasn't very hungry. I searched through an endless list of breaded and deep-fried options, finally finding a house salad hidden on a back corner.
"How's the salad?"
Angel made a face.
"I don't know. I don't eat vegetables."
"Really?" I blurted out, looking closer at her, trying to figure out how she had made it to adulthood.
"Never. Ever since I was a baby, not even a carrot. They make me gag. Vegetables, I mean."
I ordered the salad anyway, and Angel retreated to the kitchen. It was then that I realized she was also the cook, and wondered about the wisdom of my choice. My attention drifted back to the scene outside, and I watched the rapidly fading light melt into the mirrored surface of the lake. The chair beside me suddenly complained as it was pulled out. I jumped and turned to see the woman with the girl easing herself into it.
"I hope you don't mind,"
she apologized.
"Carrie, my daughter. She's into her game, won't miss me.
Just wanted someone to talk to while we wait for dinner. Oh, my name is Clarice.
Terence, I guardedly replied, not really wanting the company, but felt oddly pressured to accept.
No problem, sit down.
But Clarice already had.
Do you like wine?
She asked. I nodded.
Only red, though.
Angel!
Clarice called.
2 glasses of the house red, please.
Angel peered over the kitchen counter and smiled. I looked at Clarice for an explanation.
Oh, the old man, the owner, I mean Dimitri. Have you met him? A very unusual guy. Well, he hired me to do some painting. I really needed the work.
Clarice turned to see if her daughter was listening, then lowered her voice.
I was juggling 2 jobs, was never home. Had to do 2 or 3 shifts a day just to keep the roof over our heads. But you can't raise a child like that.
She gestured in the general direction of her daughter, then nervously began to knead her hands.
She got into some really bad stuff. I was at my wit's end. I quit my job. Tried to get things back on track with her. But then the bills piled up. You know how it is.
She asked, not expecting an answer. But I did know, and was about to agree when Angel abruptly interrupted us, placing 2 overfilled wine glasses on the table.
End of the bottle, she explained. Like I told you, we're closing soon. I can't leave stuff sitting around for the winter. We got kicked out,
Clarice continued as soon as Angel was out of earshot.
I had a little credit left on my card and an old car, that's it. And by the time we landed here, my card had been refused at the last gas station, and the tank was on empty. Dimitri gave us room and board in exchange for some work. Years ago, before I had Carrie, I was in the trades, at least while there were still buildings going up. I was a painter, but I'm almost finished the job here, maybe another day or 2 if I stretch it. After that, we've got no place to go. I'm not sure how, but I want to stay here as long as I can. It feels like the right thing to do.
Well, it sounds like they're closing in a couple of days,
I pointed out.
Angel and Dimitri never leave here. They stay all winter. I just need to find some way to help them.
She took a sip from her glass and made a face.
Ugh. I think Dimitri makes it out of grapes Angel picks from some of the abandoned vineyards back down the road. Even if he's not good at making wine, he's still a good soul. I don't know what I would have done without his help.
Clarice appeared to stop and think.
You know, he never leaves that room. The one that says private office is at the far end of the hall.
She pointed back toward the restaurant entrance.
What about you?
Just staying for a night or 2. I'm on my way to the coast.
I didn't want to talk about my problems, and I certainly didn't want to think about tomorrow just yet, so I tried to respond in a way that didn't invite further questions.
Caught in the crash, I guess,
I shrugged.
Like everyone else.
I cursed, as I tried to avoid a jagged piece of scorched metal roofing, backing up and tripping on an old metal truss that must have once held it up. Dimitri had been a collector of the unusual and obsolete, so obsessed by his passion that he surely must have almost bankrupted the hotel. I remember how the faded yellowing photos on the entrance walls greeted guests with the evidence of his collection's growth, from a small garage to a sheet metal industrial building larger than a hotel. And the sign that had been stenciled along the highway side of his corrugated aluminum skin proclaimed it to be the world's largest collection of dreams and inventions. Tours, $10. Suddenly, the memory helped me gain my bearing again, and I looked to see if I could find the line of the old building. Sweating a bit now, in the late fall sun, I spotted what I thought was the foundation and headed toward where I guessed the back of the hotel had once stood. I didn't say much through the rest of that meal. Instead, I let Clarice guide me through her troubled life. Hers seemed so much more complex than mine, making me feel that I had nothing to complain about.
Luck has never been my friend, she claimed. It's like I've been in free fall all my life without a parachute. My ex-husband, the endless stream of minimum wage jobs, then the problems with Carrie. And finally I hit ground hard about a month ago, with literally nothing left. I need to stay here. At least until things improve.
That could be years,
I soberly pointed out.
We really have nothing to go back to, and I'm sure there's something I could do here. The place needs a lot of work.
I agreed, and she paused to stare at her reflection in the glass doors for a few seconds, imagining I didn't know what.
Hey, I've got an idea.
Clarice suddenly burst out, her face brightening.
Have you seen the museum yet? Dimitri won't mind, and Angel will come too. She loves taking people through it.
As soon as I have the dishes in the washer.
Angel, who had been apparently eavesdropping, enthusiastically chirped from the kitchen.
And what about your daughter? What's her name, Kat?
I asked, trying to look for a way out.
Carrie,
Clarice corrected.
She likes staying here. It's the only place in the hotel with Wi-Fi. But let me try.
Carrie!
Clarice yelled.
We're all going to the museum. I'd love it if you'd come with us. You could show our new friend here, Terrence, your favorites.
The girl looked up from her game and shook her head.
Not tonight, I'm busy. I promised Dimitri that I would help him later.
I moved along a valley in the debris field that roughly followed the line of what I thought was the old museum building's foundation, picking out familiar scarred bits of old displays. I was surprised at how easy it was to recognize the twisted fragments. After all, I had only been here a few hours the first time, and there were now many decades in between. Perhaps the unusual nature of what I had seen there made the details stick more than other memories. I walked a bit further along until I almost tripped over an ancient electronic valve, miraculously still intact, its glass sleeve bearing the logo of a long-forgotten manufacturer. Short of breath, I was forced to sit. I picked up the valve and rolled it over in my hands, trying to imagine which amazing machine it could have come from. We left the restaurant, Clarice and Angel leading me down an irregular corridor. At a large junction, we turned. The hall straight ahead led to a glowing frosted door with faint shadows behind it.
That's Dimitri's office,
Angel casually offered, then led us off down a smaller hallway with an overhead sign that said, "To Museum." When we arrived at the entrance, an old double door, no doubt rescued from some doomed local landmark, blocked our way. It seemed to hint at what was beyond, and I was disappointed, fully expecting a collection of generic, discarded local history inside. Old cars, wagon wheels, blacksmith's tools, and the like. Angel slid a laughably simple skeleton key into a cartoon-like lock, twisted it until there was an audible clank, then the door, in a surprisingly smooth motion, swung open, revealing a scene that I would never forget. As we walked across the threshold, the hair on my arms began to tingle, tickling my skin. Angel jogged over to a bank of light switches on the closest wall and threw them on. Ceiling lights obediently sprang to life, momentarily blinding me. As my eyes adjusted, I found myself standing in an immense space dominated by a tapered trussed metal tower crowned by an onion-like shape. Faint blue sparks of energy seemed to jump from its top. Each crack made my skin crawl even more, and I instinctively backed away.
Don't worry, it's harmless. That's just the magnifying transmitter,
Angel nonchalantly replied.
The what?
I burst out, with a vague recollection from something I had read once, teasing the edge of my mind.
Oh, it just connects the turbine in the creek to all the rooms in the hotel, all wirelessly,
Angel announced automatically, as if this was something so common that it didn't deserve mention.
Of course, Dimitri says it's years ahead of his time. Saved him a fortune in wiring, so he claims.
I must have looked confused, for she added an explanation.
Dimitri had the whole system designed by this guy called Tesla. He still talks about the bladeless turbine Tesla installed in the creek. Never needs maintenance. That's the boring part, but the magnifying tower is a great draw. Kids love seeing the sparks. And there's a small receiver in each room. It's good for business. A wacky science kind of angle, I guess.
She smiled.
Tesla?
I repeated in disbelief.
Yeah, Dimitri says they were good friends. He respects the man. And no wonder, it all still works.
Angel laughed.
Huh. After all this time, too.
I'm not sure what thoughts went through my mind at that moment, but I now know that despite my skepticism, I was already hooked and wanted to believe. I held out my left arm to see if I could feel the presence of the power that had once been only meters from here. But the treatments and age had depleted my body, not leaving a hair to respond. It seemed for a moment that I had come too late, that I had failed, and was tempted to give up, but some deeply buried optimism made me get up and continue to stumble along the foundation. I just needed to get close to where the office had been, maybe another 100 meters or so, before I would know for sure. But my body was not cooperating. I quelled my fears and pressed on in pain, trying to distract myself by remembering the fabulous things that had once been housed here.
"This is called a difference engine. We're very proud of it,"
Angel announced in her affected tour guide voice. Stacks of spinning brass gears vibrated the floor as I walked over to the panel in front of the machine, its text proudly lit by a hidden spotlight.
"Charles Babbage, 1791 to 1871. This is a fully functional version, custom built for the museum by the inventor himself,"
I read aloud in disbelief.
"Huh, Dimitri made this, didn't he?"
I scoffed.
"No, it's not a replica. Charles personally supervised the fabrication under commission for Dimitri,"
Angel defensively insisted.
"Oh, come on. Babbage died over 150 years ago,"
I angrily pointed out. Seeming to ignore the implications of my comment, Angel continued.
"When I first started working for Dimitri, we used Charles' machine for the accounts. We were the first hotel to be computerized,"
she laughed.
"Huh, I even got to meet Charles once."
Stunned, I wasn't sure how to respond and felt my face redden as I began to suspect that Angel was playing with me. Was this act just part of the tour people paid $10 for, I wondered? Trying to force her to depart from the script, I smugly shot back.
"Come on, you know that the difference engine was invented in the 1800s. Despite the fact that you don't eat vegetables, you don't look that old to me." "Oh, they were truly awful back then."
Angel winked and moved on.
"What was?"
I called to her back.
"Oh, vegetables. Dirty things back then, full of worms. That's why I don't like them."
Exasperated, I turned to Clarice, who was calmly following along as if nothing was wrong. I gasped at the air in short, desperate breaths, trying to regain enough strength to move on. I had been told to expect this, but when I had set out to return here, I had thought I had more time. Maybe the shock of seeing the burnt-out ruin and the damage that its site had inflicted on my hopes had finally crushed my will, and I was only now allowing myself to admit to the truth. I'm not sure what I had been expecting to find. The hotel and the museum still here, still open? Angel and Dimitri still attending to the infrequent guests? Angel giving them late-night tours of the museum? Yes, I had to admit that was indeed what I had expected to find, and I could not let go of the hope that its most important part had somehow survived. I was sure I felt its static electric presence tease the skin on the top of my head. But could I just be imagining that? Looking around, I found an old aluminum bar, used it to prop myself up, then continued on, looking for signs that it had survived under the rubble. After all, how could it be gone? Would that even be possible? It had to have been around for a very long time, judging from Dimitri's collecting habits, and surely must have seen things far worse than a fire over the millennia. Angel led us past a room-sized rack of vacuum tubes and bundled wires. The heat the device threw off warmed my face.
"Called Colossus,"
Angel casually noted.
"Some person named Turing built it. Dimitri likes it because he says it shortened a war once, and as a side effect, helps to heat the place on cool nights."
We continued on, passing innumerable other marvels. Unknown Greek steam engines, a previously unheard of Faraday disc dynamo, a rather advanced Newcomb atmospheric engine, and a Persian abacus, so complex that it could still be used to calculate the positions of the stars and planets as accurately as a modern computer. I was overwhelmed when the tour finally came to an end, my head spinning by what I had seen in Dimitri's collection. Needing time to digest this unreal place, I simply said my goodnights and departed. Angel and Clarice headed off in the direction of the restaurant, happily chatting. When I arrived at my room, I found a hand-drawn jack-o'-lantern with the words Happy Halloween taped to the door. Clarice's daughter, I concluded. Only a few rooms in this wing of the hotel remained open. The rest of the complex, despite what Angel said, had obviously not been used this summer or any other summer in the last decade. With only a couple of rooms, I didn't understand how they could afford to keep the place going. I poked a brass punch card into the door slot, making it obediently click open, letting out the faint sour odor of ozone. I slipped in and closed the door. The corner of the room was occupied by a miniature version of the magnifying transmitter from the museum. It anxiously sparked with energy. The source of the ozone smell, I guessed. Not feeling tired enough to sleep, I turned on a bedside lamp, pulled an e-reader out of my bag, propped my head up with pillows, and began to read. I'm not sure when I fell asleep, but I woke up with a start to a pitch-black room. The lamp on the night table had been turned off. I didn't remember doing that. Another of Dimitri's lost inventions, I wondered. My thoughts were abruptly interrupted by voices in the hall outside my room. Then two shadows passed through the thin wedge of wan light that spilled under my door. I could just make out Clarice trying to whisper to her daughter.
Quiet, Carrie. We don't want to wake up Terrence.
Carrie protested, but I couldn't make out what she was saying. I could only catch a few more words as they moved off down the hall.
Dimitri said it's time.
At least I think that was what Clarice had said. Then Carrie choked back a giggle of excitement, and they were gone. Silence returned, but images from the museum and questions circled in my mind, pushing off sleep to some unreachable land. Knowing that I was going to be awake for hours, I got up and decided to explore. I wandered through the empty halls where the lights still shone, getting lost several times. It quickly became apparent that the hotel had not been planned. Rather, it had been added to, over and over, each addition like a different unrelated thought, a layer surrounding the older part like some weird hybrid onion held together by the bright skin of the tin roof that covered everything. Eventually feeling tired, I tried to find my way back to my room and got thoroughly lost. Finally, I stumbled onto the main desk. To one side of it, tacked to the wall, was a portrait of Dimitri that I hadn't noticed when I had checked in, and under the photo was a paragraph of text. Not having brought my glasses, I squinted at the type, trying to decipher what it stated. I thought I could make out the man's birth date, but my tired eyes played tricks in the iffy light, closing loops where there shouldn't have been any. 18? I began to read aloud. The last two digits of the birth date were too hard to interpret. I was sure that the year didn't start with a 2, but how could that be? It was definitely a 1 followed by an 8, but it didn't make any difference. He would still be older than any human possibly could be. Frustrated, I decided to go back to my room and examine the photo and text again in the morning, under better conditions. In familiar territory now, I began to retrace my way to the museum, and from there back to my room. I started down the long hall again, eventually coming to the junction, and was about to turn toward the museum when I heard a noise coming from the glow behind Dimitri's office door. There were several shadows behind the glass panel in the door's center. Curious, I silently approached and tested it. The door swung slightly ajar. Feeling like I was an unwanted stranger intruding on somebody's very private life, I carefully nosed my head forward to see into the room. But my face seemed to meet some kind of unforeseen force, as if the air was turning into a liquid. I pushed until the resistance was too much, finally shifting my feet until I could get one eye into the open slit. Nothing made sense. The room was crammed, ceiling to floor, with indescribable devices of every shape. Parts floating in midair flocked around four figures. Angel, Clarice, her daughter, and the man in the portrait from the front desk, Dimitri. But he looked identical to his captured image, as if the photo had been taken yesterday. Even stranger, all four hovered, seemingly frozen, feet not quite touching the floor. They were caught in the act of manipulating one very alien machine, which poured a thick, viscous atmosphere into the room from gill-like vents along its sides. Then slowly, so imperceptibly slow that they almost didn't appear to move, Clarice's eyes began to swing toward the crack I was peering through. Our eyes met, and Clarice's eyes seemed to twinkle with joy. To this day, I know that somehow, despite the fact that she appeared to be only a few steps away, she was looking at me across an unimaginably vast gap. To her, I must have had the presence of a housefly, momentarily alighting on the edge of the door before flitting away. Bewildered and frightened, not knowing what to do, I ran back to my room, packed up, and left. That scene has haunted me ever since, burnt into my mind. But it was only years after that night that I began to understand. Some exotic machine from the past, or, for all I know, from the future, that Dimitri had found, somehow created a sort of bubble or gap in the flow of time. When I had first received the diagnosis, I immediately thought of that night and knew my only chance was to return to the room, the gap, where time was standing still, or moving so slowly that things like a rapidly progressing terminal disease didn't matter. All those years ago, Clarice had understood, and she had wanted to stay to wait for better times and better luck. I had been too distracted back then with my problems and fears to see it for myself. The lightning bolts of pain were coming faster now, making it almost impossible to breathe. I gasped, stumbling forward, leaning on my makeshift walking stick. The mound of rubble that used to be the office was so close now I could almost touch it. Exhausted, I was forced to stop and sat down, not sure if I could go any further, and was almost ready to give up. I calmed my breathing, and silence eventually closed in, revealing the almost imperceptible crackle of static. Turning my head to see where it had come from, I spotted a crude arch haphazardly formed by several slabs of broken concrete, and there, in its heart, a tunnel, with a familiar glow at its end. I forced myself up one last time and hobbled toward it.
Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 59, Somewhere, Sometime, The Gap. We hope that you enjoyed this month's story. As always, if you like what we are doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on iTunes. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com, or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. The opening and closing theme is Podsafe Music by David H. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution, no derivative license, which means that you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't change anything.